netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. Today, Mike Seymour is going to talk about the visual effects of the film Sucker Punch with two members of the Animalogic team. Before we listen to that, I wanted to take a second because there's been so much going on over at the sites, FX Guide and FX PhD. If you're just listening to the podcast, I wanted to make sure you got a chance to hear about some stuff you should be checking out. First of all, FX Guide TV has been on fire lately. If you go back to episode 103, normally before NAB, we get all the information about the upcoming Autodesk releases, and this year we got it a little early, so you'll see all about all the Autodesk products, 2012 releases, in that episode number 103 of FX Guide TV. Plus, on the site, there's over 2 hours of additional material, which, especially if you're a Flame user, you're really going to want to check that out. There's so much great stuff in the 2012 release that, you know, like I say, there's 2 hours of video kind of highlighting that. After that, Ian Fales did an interview with Douglas Trumbull down at the recent Adelaide Film Festival. This is a great interview. And then we follow that up with the most recent episode of FX Guide TV, which I have to say is one of the best interviews we've ever done. Mike Seymour sits down and talks with Rob Legato. It was so good that we released the FX Guide TV episode, but we also put together 36 additional minutes that we offered up to our FX Insiders. FX Insiders is our new program designed to allow us to expand the coverage that we offer to production and visual effects business worldwide. We've hired new writers and web programmers to help us do that. We're in no way reducing the amount of free content. In fact, with FX Insider, we'll actually have more content than we've had in the past. But if you become an FX Insider, here's what you get. For $49, as a thank you, you get 1 year of VIP access to exclusive content. Things like this extended interview with Rob Legato and high-res imagery. Also, things like in the Ken Ralston podcast, insiders got access to a special PDF that kind of broke down each of the different effects in Alice. So FX Insider is kind of our thank you back to you for helping support the site, which for so many years has operated just on minimal banner advertising. Insiders will also get an invitation to the NAB party we hold for FX PhD members. All right, there's lots of other great stuff on the site, like some footage we shot with the new Epic camera from Red for the next term over at FX PhD. There's lots about the new camera and everything having to do with production world and the RC podcast. And Mike, John, and Stu Mashwit spent an amazing week in New Zealand for that new course I was mentioning, putting the Epic through its paces, helicopter shots, boat to boat, car to car, pushing the HDRX. They even shot some footage from a zip line. Anyway, very excited to see this class in the new term, which is announced April 1st. All right, I could go on a long time with NAB coming up. There's so much going on, and we'll be at NAB, of course, in full coverage mode. But let's jump into this podcast. As I mentioned, Mike Seymour is going to talk with two members of the Animalogic team about Sucker Punch. Later in the podcast, we'll hear from Animalogic's visual effects supervisor, Andy Brown. But Mike starts off the interview with CG supervisor, Andrew Chapman.
Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So what were the challenges for handling a scene of this complexity in terms of just like the volume of both, well, assets and textures? Because it's a very detailed scene.
Yeah, I guess the biggest challenge was the amount of stuff and the different kinds of stuff that's going into it. And also the fact that we're getting pretty close to things when we're in the courtyard with the girls and the our set extensions are just, you know, 20 meters that way. And then you pull out to a giant wide aerial shot and it's the same castle. So, yeah, having to build everything to a really high level to hold up that close to camera, and also not kill our render farm when we're in the wides, and being able to just throw props and terrains and castle and digital fire and creatures and crowd and all the Atmos and everything all in there at once.
Let's just talk about a shot there for a second. Like, there's a nice shot where later in the sequence the dragon is chasing the plane, mm-hmm. And it so happens to trick it into smashing into a bridge. Now, there seemed to me to be just about every department that you could possibly want having to have a dog in this fight, because there was a lot going on in that, wasn't there?
Yeah. We almost killed our previous artist, Cameron, when we came back with a few of these shots. And we knew we had to build them for real. But yeah, there's certain sort of key points or of difficulty in the sequence, and certainly the creature crashing through the bridge was one of our two scariest moments. The other one is one of the close up all digi double shots near the end of the sequence. But yeah, having a digital creature crash into a digital bridge covered with crowds, simmed in massive, and all the debris out of Houdini, and then our custom fire sims going on at the same time, along with everything else.
Yeah, and everything else, let's not skip everything else. Everything else is like massive amounts of background detail. Yeah. There was effects animation in terms of Atmos, because camera's moving, so we've got like a whole kind of sweeping sense of the environment going on. And then there's a ton of kind of performance of the way it crashes in. It's not like a stupid just bump into it thing and we can't wait. It's,
they're quite... DJ was quite adamant that the dragon wasn't ever goofy.
Yeah.
It happened to crash into the bridge, but it didn't particularly care. When it's setting the knights on fire, he was sort of acting it out at one point. He's just like, I set you guys on fire. I don't care. That's not what I was meaning to do. And then after the plane again, and when she's crashing through the courtyard at the end, doing her big belly flop, it's not like she lost control and crashed through the middle of everything. She just doesn't care. She's going after her target and always in control. But such a big creature just crashing through everything was pretty fun to do.
But when I said every department had a dog in this fight, it's a kind of an interrelationship that makes these things seem to work for me. Because in these scenes, what's nice is that it's not as if, you know, you've got a primary and everything else is just secondary and is just incidental. There's a lot of sort of really nice Sims work that's feeding almost back on the animation of the dragon, that's feeding the massive response. Is there a prioritization to that in terms of animation, or are you just having an iterative process over and over again?
Well, certainly all the hero animation was our first pass, and that was the main thing that we had to get right. And obviously you've got to stick a flag in the sand at some point and say, that bit's done, now everybody else do your work, because with everything interacting in that way, somebody changing something at one end of the process is going to completely mess everybody else up. So certainly the dragon being the hero creature was the first thing to go through, and certainly right through to final animation sign-off before we let our crowd and effects guys at it. And then, we next in line, I guess, was the crowd. We had some really happy accidents and some excellent work out of our crowd team to produce some of that detail in those sequences. But you could watch a few of those shots, and we did. We watched them over and over again, and everyone sort of laughing and pointing out different ways that the knights were dying in amusing fashion throughout the shots that were just accidents.
It seems to me that this
simulation
is a sequence that really takes full benefit of Animal's duality of being both an effects house in the traditional sense, this is live action against green screen, but also there have got to be fully digital shots of a lineage from a Happy Feet sort of fully animated sense, that it's both things going on for one.
And I think that was what so many of the people here that were going to be working on it were so excited about, because having spent so much time on the animated features, sort of getting back into that mix of everything, people were quite excited to, you know, have the plate photography to work on again as another element into that mix, on top of all the rich CG that Animal's so good at producing now.
How are you going about handling this? I mean, we've talked about a lot of assets, and that's, you know, most people think of that as being a database, but, you know, somebody at some point has to be sitting in front of a monitor comping those together, getting that balance right. Are you aiming to nail as much as you can in the animation render phase, or are you wanting to just render out as many elements as possible and rely on the eye of the compositor to balance those out in a sequence like the dragon hitting the bridge?
Throughout the process, you're always trying to do as good a job as you can in each individual department. The struggle that we had with this was just such extreme schedule that we were under. I mean, the whole project was about 9 months, and so developing everything, each asset in isolation, and producing a beautiful dragon, and then you get it into lighting and you try and produce your beautiful lighting, and then you sort of look ahead a bit and think, the deadline's coming up pretty quick, let's get into comping it. So really praising our comp team that struggled, they got these shots done with just a fraction of the time that they should have had to really, really comp them in the end. And they did such a great job in layering up all the Atmos and really enriching the plates. If you look at the plates as we receive them, it's just these tiny little postage stamps of partial sets in amongst a sea of green. And there's really no amount of pristine CG that you can lay in back there and have a photographic looking shot. It's got that then really has to come back to comp to lay in all of the elements and naturalistic look to it to make a rich shot again.
And if that's really hard because there are so many layers and you've got to really balance them to make the shot work, at the other end of the spectrum there are shots where you're doing, you know, digital lead cast followed intercut by live action of the actual same cast member, and like the hair, for example, you did what, new hair renderers for this? Is that right?
Yeah, our R&D guys came up with a new hair system called Alfro, and it's one of the things that we've been trying to sort of tick certain boxes to be able to make sure that we can do each type of effect that, that comes up commonly in films. And so being able to do full digital doubles with clothing and hair, the hair was the final tick box to make sure that we could do. So even though our sequence, we only had relatively few all digital double shots.
Well, you say that modestly, but there are slow-mo close-up shots right before another slow-mo close-up shot of the real actress.
Yeah, so we had a couple of very, very difficult shots, but I think we sort of realised that having a really high-level hair system is something that would be great to have, and so we used the project as a basis for really launching it and writing that tool. So yes, although it's shown up in a few shots, we've come out of it with great technology for doing digital doubles and long hair in the future.
And the other thing, of course, that we get in slow motion, because it's a dragon, is Fireball's volumetric kind of flames. And they seem to be working really nicely. Were they easily directable, or were they just hardcore sims?
Nothing's easily directable that takes 2 days to turn around. The tools are great, but there's a limit to how quickly you can iterate towards a creative brief on something that you're only seeing so infrequently. So it was a bit of a mix of some great tools. We've got a parallel simming fluid simulation tool, so the guys could spray their sims really wide across the farm and get results back quickly from that.
But that's all a CPU approach, right? You don't have
GPU.
Yes,
it is. No.
So it's still going to be pretty hardcore on...
They do take a while. And so some of them we could see once per day, but the really big hero ones, particularly, again, the dragon crashing through the bridge because it's starting and stopping and starting within the shot, they took a long while to get and came in near the end of the schedule, so we were quite happy when we got those ones in the bag and we knew.
Because the trouble is, when a dragon is, for example, flying and projecting flame out in front of it, you have the problem that I have in my head that the flame would all move and stay well out in front of the dragon, whereas Sim might actually have the sort of dragon flying through its own flames. And, of course, just because it's mathematically correct doesn't make it cinematically valid.
Yeah.
You do need to control these things.
Yeah, so one thing we all knew we didn't want to do is have her cooking her own face off as she flew through the sky. So... Initially, that was one of the things to play around with and get right, was the sort of balance between the projected fire and the blowback from the air, that volume that she's flying through. And also just sort of cheating things a little bit, like if she's flying at you and breathing fire, just making her tilt her head a little bit so that you as the camera, the fire will always pull away and clear the frame so that you're always still seeing through to her and she's not flying through it again. But if you then look at all that action from another perspective, the fire won't look right. It is all a bit of a cheat, because if you did what's physically realistic, it wouldn't look great from the camera's point of view. So
it's one of the things I really like, and I don't know why I like it so much, is there's this gorgeous close-up of the dragon's eye, and it seemed to me there was like a lot of depth in that eye, and it just didn't seem that simple to do. But I can imagine it looked pretty simple in a storyboard frame.
That storyboard was showing up for a while just as a simplistic outline of an eye, as the rest of the animatic around it was evolving, and we were kind of hoping, crossing our fingers that shot might go away. But after a while we realised we did have to build that extreme close-up on the eye. So we took our base dragon model and texturing and really just forked off a copy of it and built it specifically for that shot. JP, our head of surfacing, and Raf of rigging, between themselves did all the custom modelling and really pushed that one shot up, you know, several levels from where the rest of the dragon would be.
Yeah, there's some really nice sort of, I know it's an overused term, but it's like layered up, like there's actually sort of depth between the surface specular highlights and through to the various parts of the eye. But I'm wondering, like, whose eye is the basis of a dragon's eye? Is it literally just a lizard or a crocodile, or is this like part cat, part animal logic eye?
One of the things Animal has put a bit of quite a bit of effort into is the eye shading and the look of the eyes. I mean, having had to tell these stories on the CG animation side of it, and so much of that emotion comes through the eyes, so that is something that they've got right. So,
well, you guys last year did such a great job with Legends of the Galhula, and those eyes for the owls last year were obviously central to their performance.
Yeah,
so but nevertheless, it's a bloody great eye on shot. And,
so we stole the basis of their eyes, the actual geometry of how you model it, and some of their shading technology, and then just for that one shot, pushed it up a level for our full screen eye.
Well, next time you're talking to the guy that did the eye, just say that I certainly thought it was really good, and the whole thing was great. So thanks for talking to us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm in love, I guess, if that's the right word, with the dragon in the sequence that Animal Logic did. There's a shot where it comes up from behind the body of its dead offspring, and it's just incredibly vivid. And I guess clean shot in the sense we actually really get to appreciate your work. Mm. Were you pleased with that shot? Mm. You must have.
Yeah, I think that's one of our favourite shots, one of my favourite shots. And in fact, it stood out. We did a temp version of that 4 weeks before we did finals, and that was looking pretty good then, so we really had time to finesse that particular shot. But that shot really stood out. I mean, it almost has a kind of painterly, kind of Rembrandt kind of look to it, which I quite liked. And it's not often you actually get to have like a close, intimate moment with a large dragon.
Yeah, because we're not put off by the motion of a camera or massive amounts of explosions or fire or atmos. We get to see and appreciate the work, but also you get an expression that actually is a performance from a character that otherwise would normally not do much.
Yeah, it's definitely what we're trying to do there is, you know, baby doll has just slain. She's a mother. She's a mother dragon. We call her her son. So we wanted to get across this moment of a moment of grief before the rage.
So the dragon's face, let's discuss getting that look. I mean, we described it as being almost like a Rembrandt, but there's a lot going on there, not just lighting, there's texturing on the surface.
I mean, when we first came aboard, as Aaron Sims did some initial designs for the dragon, but we took those on board and did a lot of development. We built a prototype dragon in ZBrush, and spent at least 2.5 months sculpting that and solving the design of the dragon. And by the end of that process, we had a very high detailed sculpt of the face. And we spent a lot of time looking at the teeth, the eyes, you know, and surface detail. And obviously, once that was locked, we got into actual surfacing of that.
And that sequence is kind of intimate in a sense, if you can call it that. Because, you know, we're a closed environment, and actually the physical shape of the building at this point is kind of circular, and we're in it and down in it. But what I really felt is that once we came out of that environment, there was massive amounts of depth layered up in the shots. How much difficulty was there to sort of keep that going? And also, you had this lovely reason to fly around a castle. Normally, there are gratuitous fly-arounds, and they feel unmotivated. But here we actually had a plane circling the castle, so you really got to see off into the distance.
Depth-wise, we had a lot of the exterior landscape back there was, you know, a combination of fully shaded environments plus projected matte paintings out in the distant landscape. And we did a lot of the atmospherics were done in a comp, layering up elements plus adding in effects, atmos passes as well.
So I've described this castle having enormous depth shooting off, but of course you actually were on set when they were filming it, and I think you're going to tell me that you probably didn't have 6 kilometres of green screen and a set the size of a castle.
No, it's funny. It's funny when you bid a show and you always think in your head that the set's going to be much bigger, and so we rocked up and it was probably half stage worth of set, and so quite a small courtyard, and a bit of the staircase going up to the chimney was. And the front gate of the castle was pretty much all they'd built. So, a lot of green screen and a huge amount of set extension work.
The cast is obviously naturally, you know, younger. Did you give them, or was there anything provided to help them kind of understand this massive space that they were in? In other words, did you have any kind of prevising or tools for on-set previewing? Because it must have been hard to sort of visualize that amount of epic environment.
No, we had Cameron, our previous artist, was went over to Vancouver 2 weeks ahead of us, and he worked with DJ to map out the entire sequence. So they, for every shot they had, we had a previous version of it to show the cast what was going on, which direction they were looking at. I mean, some of the fight scenes were a little more... we didn't quite know which way we were looking all the time, but because it was the choreography was quite loose at times. But you know, specific areas like going up steps of the chimney, we could show them, you know, what was up there. And
so, away from principal cast, how many nights and how many extras of actually fighters were there on set to get that kind of build up?
I think we had 20 all up stunt guys that they used, and they could be swapped out as knights or orcs, so probably 10 of each.
There's some really funky moves in this, obviously. It's a very dramatic piece. Did you end up having to do any digital body replacements or literally cast replacements of the principal cast for any of the kind of wild moves?
Yeah, several. There's we had a digital double for all the characters, but we did one shot, which is a close-up shot of Baby Doll in the air with a close-up of the sword. You tilt down and look... look directly down on her as she's about to kill the dragon at the end.
That entire she's in the air over
she's
flames.
Sorry, I forgot to mention. She's in the air. The dragon's below her, crashing through the gate.
It's a great shot.
Fire's coming up, and that entire sequence was fully CG. So yes, so we had to build a very high resolution baby doll, which actually MPC did, and we actually shared the builds of the assets across the company. So we had five characters to build. We did Sweet Pea and Rocket.
And of course, as is the director's stylistic preference, there's those slow-mo shots, so you won't be able to hide it in the cut, because the shots we're describing actually are playing out quite slowly in terms of screen time, so it must have been quite challenging to make sure, because, you know, it's literally cut-to-cut matching live-action to digital.
It was definitely very tricky. In fact, there's one shot too where we had to replace a live-action wide gag where she's the shot before that, sort of profile view of her just falling down on top of the dragon's head. There we actually replaced the live-action element just because they wanted to just add a little subtle twist to the body, so we had to match that exactly, and it was very hard to do.
Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. As I said, we're set to deliver huge NAB coverage with articles, FX Guide TV episodes, the RC, Jason's coming over again. If you're at NAB, look for us. We'll be easy to spot. We'll have an epic on a Steadicam. And on Tuesday afternoon, we're hosting sessions at the Post Pit on the floor of the NAB show. And as I mentioned, if you're an FX PhD member or an FX insider, we're hosting a party at NAB, so look for an invitation for that. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.